Hi, this is Katie Floyd, sitting in for Allison Sheridan of the new Silicast Mac podcast, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, August 21st, 2011, and this is show number 326. Okay, guys, did I get that intro right? Because you know I'm very nervous about doing all of these types of things. So as you may have heard, our fearless leader was on vacation this week and asked me to step in and host the show in her absence, and I was delighted to have the opportunity to do so and hang out with the No Silla Castaways again. After all, this was a pretty light week for me. You know, all I had to do was pack up all my worldly possessions and move to a new home. And then all I had to do was unpack everything I own and get the house organized and get the boxes out of my house and set up all the technology in my life. And now that was actually the fun part. And then I had to coordinate a bunch of workmen and installers around my house and all the last minute stuff that the builder didn't take care of. And I also had to work 40 hours a week, and then I had to record my own podcast with David. And then the Mac power users had to move over to the 5x5 network. So that was a whole nother can of worms. But you know what? As research assistant Niraj would say, easy peasy. So no problem. But just as a quick plug for me, if you haven't heard, my regular show, Mac Power Users, hosted over at www.macpowerusers.com, moved this week to become associated with the Mighty 5x5 network. So if you're currently subscribed to the show, nothing should change, although we might have duplicated the feed on you during our move. Sorry about that. But if you've never heard of us, now's a great time to check us out because we're better than ever. So enough about me. Time to start the show. So knowing that I had such a crazy week in store for me, and I had all these plate-spinning things that I need to do to get this live show going, because it is really, really hard, the No Silla Castaways came together and submitted a bunch of great content for this week's show. But of course, it wouldn't be a No Silla Cast without a word from our good friend, Professor Albert. Now, since Professor Albert knew how busy I was this week, he didn't have a dumb question for me, but he had a couple of questions for all of you.
Hello there, Katie Floyd. This is Professor Albert. You are one of my favorite podcasters there with the Mac Power Users. You and that Mac Sparky. Oh my God, you are so smart. I love your podcast there. It makes me feel all powerful and very geeky too. That's why I love it. Thank you for being here for Allison as she is cruising in the Mediterranean on her podcasting yacht. Well, I have some dumb questions for the No Silla Castaways. I don't want to drive you crazy trying to answer these questions, so these are for the wonderful No Silla Castaways. Here we go. If you put software on a hard drive, why isn't it called a soft drive? Does a kilobyte bite? And if it does, do you die from it? Why does my body look wimpy and out of shape on my high-definition eyesight camera? When I put my computer to sleep, why doesn't it snore? And when I sleep it, should I put pajamas on it, or should I sleep it in a buff? What is the difference between a megabyte and a Big Mac? Yesterday I nuked and paved my computer. So now, how do I get the tar on my melted Mac out of my microwave oven? You are very wonderful, Katie Floyd.
Thanks, Professor. So, dear listeners, if you can help Professor Albert with any of these issues, please feel free to write in. And remember, Allison's back next week. So why don't you send your responses to her at allison@podfeet.com. Okay, so I guess it's time for me to do a little work here. Chief No Silla Castaway Steve Sheridan recently acquired his very first iPhone, and you may have seen pictures of his fun-filled vacation on Twitter this past week, so he's obviously getting great use out of it. Steve sent out a call for help a couple of weeks ago asking what kind of apps he should install on his brand new iPhone, and I figured Steve likely wasn't the only person who could benefit from some app advice. Because, you know, the rumor mills are buzzing with the pending launch of the new iPhone 5, and I'm guessing we'll likely see some new iPhone owners out there in the coming months. So I thought I'd take this opportunity to share with Steve and all the other listeners out there my 10 must-have iPhone apps. Now, I tried to stay away from some of the more obvious apps like, you know, Twitter and Facebook, because people are going to figure out those on themselves. So these are my 10 must-have iPhone apps that are maybe not quite as well-known, but you've probably heard of some of them. Number one, 1Password. If you're not using a password manager, you're likely not being as secure as you should with your passwords. 1Password is an application that generates, stores, and autofills passwords for all of your various websites, but it gives you access to all of these passwords by using a single master password, your 1Password. With an app like 1Password, there's no reason to use insecure passwords or to repeat the same password across multiple sites. They have a Mac and a PC version, as well as mobile versions for your iPhone and iPad, and they use Dropbox to keep all of your information in sync. The 1Password application on my iPhone and iPad makes sure that I have all of my passwords with me wherever I am and allows me to secure a place and store my sensitive information. That's why 1Password is one of my must-have apps. And by the way, links to all of this will be in the show notes. Number 2, Evernote. Evernote is the place where I store everything else in my life. Random pieces of information like the dimensions of my furniture, a list of movies that I want to watch, places where I need to update my address, the funky names of the makeup that I buy because I can never remember them when I'm at the counter, recipes because I don't actually have enough to use a dedicated recipe program, notes from meetings, and so forth and so on. They have clients for just about every platform, as well as a web interface, so you never have to be without your notes. Evernote has been branded as an external brain, and I like to think of that as a good analogy. If there's something random that I need to remember, but it doesn't really fit anywhere else, it goes into Evernote. Instagram. Instagram is a fairly new addition to my iPhone, and it fills a void. So here's the problem. Now that I've got this fancy camera on my iPhone, I'm taking a lot of photos that I want to share. Some of them I want to share with my Twitter friends, some I want to share on Facebook, some on both. But I don't want to go to the individual apps and post one here and post one there. Problem solved with Instagram. Instagram will allow you to post a photo to multiple services at the same time, but it also does a whole lot more. It's got a slew of neat visual effects that you can apply to your photos, and will also allow you to take photos as well, and it has its own web interface for storing photos. So Instagram really feels a need for me. Number 4, delivery status touch. I obviously have a problem because I have a lot of deliveries. I do most of my shopping online, so the FedEx and UPS guy come to my door a little more often than they probably should. It's tough to keep track of everything because I usually come home through the back door, and I've had occasions where a package sat at my front door for days because I've forgotten to check. Delivery status touch to the rescue. Once you get the notification of delivery, you simply copy the number, open the app, and Delivery Status Touch will recognize the contents of the clipboard as a tracking number and ask to add it. If you allow the app, it will send you push notifications and letting you know your package progress. And once you open it, it will give you an at-a-glance status of all of your packages and letting you know just how many days to delivery. It's really been a lifesaver. Number 5, Card Munch. I have a problem where people give me their business cards and the information never gets where it should. So I was looking around for an app that I could use to take a picture of a business card and import the information into my address book. I found several, but they all use traditional OCR technology, which is about 90% accurate. 90% is good, but if you think about it, there are 10 digits in a standard US phone number, and 90% accuracy, and you got a problem. Card Munch takes a different approach. While I'm sure they use some OCR as an initial pass at the card, they also have live human beings at the other end that reviews your card for accuracy. Of all the cards I've submitted, the information returned has been accurate. Once the information is processed in the Card Munch app, you can have it in your separate Card Munch address book or decide whether or not you want to add it to your main iPhone address book. If you do and you use a service like MobileMe or Google, it will sync to everywhere else. This is great because maybe you scan a card at a conference because you want the information, but you don't want it in your real address book. So now, I just snap a picture of a business card and hand it back to the person. Why should I have to deal with keeping up with it? Nothing else to fuss with. Really like Card Munch. They've recently been bought out by LinkedIn, so it used to be a pay service per card, but now it's free with your LinkedIn account. Not quite sure how they'll be able to sustain it, but I plan on keeping track of it as long as I can. Number 6. Card Start. I'm all about keeping up with less items. Less fuss to deal with in life, the better. But I do like taking advantage of bargains, and I hate carrying around a big fat wallet. In a perfect world, I'd carry my ID and debit card and be done with it, but I can't quite get that minimalistic. With Card Start, though, I can come close. Because I always have my iPhone, Card Start allows me to import all of the information from these reward cards and store them on my phone. So when I'm at CVS or Ace Hardware and the cashier asks me for my reward card, all I have to do is launch the app, select the appropriate store, and a barcode appears on the screen for the cashier to scan. On a couple of occasions, I've had CVS give me trouble using this and refuse to scan my iPhone because, get this, they were afraid of catching a virus. But in that case, I just had them read the number and punch it in manually, which was still better than carrying around the card. Number 7, Text Expander. So Allison's already told you how great Text Expander is on the Mac, and I'm sure she'll do so again later in this show. But now you can have some of that functionality on your iPhone as well with their iOS app. Text Expander has built a development kit that allows other developers to build in Text Expander touch support into their apps, and over 100 applications so far support Text Expander. So if you're using a compatible app, just type your Text Expander snippet like you're used to on your Mac, and the characters expand. Unfortunately, not all apps support Text Expander, so there's also a standalone application where you can create, sync, and compose your snippets, and then copy or export the information into any other non-supported applications. A new recent addition is that Text Expander now syncs snippets over Dropbox to your iPhone, so you can have the same snippets on your Mac and your iOS device instantly without any funky syncing over Wi-Fi. Heaven! Number 8, Instapaper. I'll frequently be browsing Twitter and a friend has posted a link to something interesting that I want to read, but perhaps don't have the time to catch it right then and there. That's where Instapaper comes in. You can either use it as an integrated service into an app that supports it, or you can use their Safari bookmarklet, or you can email a link to a special address, and it will quickly save those websites into your Instapaper account. Using the iPhone app, it will download the text of those saved articles in an easy-to-read format for the iPhone so that when you have a few minutes in the day, you can review the article. I find that throughout the day, I bookmark a half dozen or so articles, and then maybe at lunch or when I have a few minutes either waiting in the courthouse or standing in line, I'll pull up Instapaper and be able to easily review my reading list. Number 9, Google Voice. Google Voice is a service that we could probably devote an entire segment to in and of itself. And maybe I will one day. But in a nutshell, Google Voice allows you to give people one phone number, and when dialed, it will ring another or multiple numbers. Or you can also set up specific rules within Google Voice to have it ring only certain times of the day, or to screen calls, or to block certain calls, or to only allow calls from certain groups of people. For example, my Google Voice number rings my cell phone, my home phone, and the direct extension at my desk. I also have it set that after certain hours of the day, that it only rings calls from certain select people that I've chosen. Google Voice also offers some interesting voicemail transcription services and other features like SMS messaging. Because I have a very limited text messaging plan, I'll give people my Google Voice number instead to text me at. For example, this past year at Macworld, someone set up a texting group where members of the Mac Roundtable could send text messages to the entire group. It was a lot of fun, but I must have gotten a couple of hundred text messages within the span of a week, and that would have totally blown my limited texting plan. With Google Voice, those text messages all came in for free, bypassing AT&T, which is even more important now because AT&T has announced that they're getting rid of all of their text messaging plans except for the unlimited one. So if you're not already grandfathered in, you soon won't be able to buy one other than the unlimited plan. I can see a day coming in the very near future when Google Voice may be the only phone number that I give people. And finally, number 10, Find My iPhone. If you have a new iPhone, I strongly suggest that you activate this free service from Apple. If your iPhone is ever lost or stolen, with Find My iPhone, you might have a shot at recovering it, or at the very least, you can lock it down to avoid some data lost. Last month, we were out of town having dinner to celebrate my brother's college graduation. Yay, Matt! And my dad has a bad habit of putting his iPhone on the dinner table, but this time he walked off and left it. We were down the road before he realized that it was missing. Less than a minute after the discovery, I had already pulled up his iPhone using Find My iPhone on my iPhone, and we locked the device because, of course, despite my rantings about it, he didn't have a passcode on his phone. But we were able to verify that the phone was still at the restaurant. Fortunately, this story has a happy ending and the iPhone was recovered, no harm, no foul. But my point is, this is a service that takes a few minutes to set up and you can avoid a catastrophe down the road. Okay. Well, that was a long list and I'm exhausted. So let's take a quick break with a word from Allison about our first sponsor, Screen Steps and Clarify.
You use technology, which means that things go wrong sometimes. You have to write to the developer from time to time and explain the problem you're having. You've probably spent a lot of time elaborately explaining the problem only to have the developer write back and ask you clarifying questions. What if in a few quick and easy steps, you could take a few screenshots of where the software fails, annotate those images with arrows and boxes to make sure they don't miss your point, and then just put in a few words and have them know exactly what you meant the problem was? That's the idea behind BlueMango Learning's new application called Clarify, now in public beta. After you throw the steps together, simply click Share, and it uploads to a link at clarify.com/forward directly to the vendor. If you want, you can copy the document to the clipboard and paste it into an email so they have it right there, too. Or how about this use case? I bet you've tried to explain something to your father over the phone, say, 28 times, but he just doesn't remember it, right? How about if you make a clarified document he can print out and keep by the computer from now on, and you'd both be happier? Now remember, of course, that you can still get screen steps for the heavy lifting when you need to write a training manual or complex lessons. Having Clarify at your fingertips in addition to screen steps gives you just that ability to bang out that quick little email, that quick little problem you're having, or just teach somebody really short, something quick and easy to explain but is so easily misunderstood if you don't have pictures and annotations. You know, I'm really excited about the niche that Clarify fills for regular people. Not all of us write these big manuals and this sort of thing, and we just need that tool that does that one thing really, really well. I'd love it if you checked out the beta and gave BlueMango Learning feedback on how Clarify works for you. They're being very responsive, fixing problems, changing the way things work a little bit when people write to them. So I think you'll really enjoy playing with it. Check it out at BlueMangoLearning.com/clarify. It's a chance to test drive a new product for free and to help them develop an even better product.
Okay, well, this live show stuff is hard work, so I'm going to sit back and take a break for a while and let some of the Nosilla castaways chime in with their reviews. First up is Kirshen with a review of the Laplog for iPad.
Hi, Kirshen from freerangecoder.com, here with a review. This time I'm looking at an iPad accessory called Laplog. But first, what's the problem to be solved? Well, it's that you have to use one hand to hold the iPad while sitting on your easy chair, and you're left with the other hand to interact. Or you wind up contorting your legs to prop your iPad up. Sure, you could use the smart cover or iPad cases which fold up as a prop to hold up the iPad, but you're usually stuck with the iPad at one, maybe two ankled positions. And then my partner Sarah found the Laplog at thelaplog.com. It's a cylindrical pillow filled with buckwheat hulls, very eco-friendly. The Laplog has a wooden insert that has a U-shaped bracket sticking out of the side. You fluff the pillow, put it on your lap, and then slide the iPad into the bracket. It's that easy. You can put the iPad in either the portrait or landscape orientation. What's more, in the portrait mode, there's a convenient cutout for the home button. How very thoughtful. As a result, I have two hands free. I can get to type with both hands on the on-screen keyboard. The neat thing about the Laplog pillow is that you can shape it to change the angle of the iPad to suit your viewing position, and you don't even need to sit it on your lap. Just put it on the handy seat-back tray table when you're traveling by air, and voila, it is a stand. The Laplog is 5 inches in diameter and 10 inches long, and weighs about 18 ounces. Small and light enough to stash in your carry-on bag. Laplog says that you can use it as a handy neck pillow too. It's one of those travel items you want to make sure that you pack for easy access in your rollerboard. Such a useful thing. If it gets dirty, no problem. You can remove the wooden insert, pour out the buckwheat hulls, and wash the very durable cylindrical fabric cover. Gentle cycle, please. Sarah purchased one for her mum as a birthday present so she could use it with her iPad. I wound up borrowing it and liked it so much I got my own. I'm actually typing the notes for this review using the Apple Bluetooth keyboard and the iPad propped up in the Laplog, on my lap, in my easy chair, naturally. The other neat thing is that you won't get a toasty lap as with a conventional laptop. That's a win for the post-PC devices. go on and check it out at thelablog.com. It's priced at $39.95 for the standard design. There are special limited editions with various pattern designs too. Those will run you $49.95. Don't have an iPad? What, one of those other tablets? No worries. The Lablog will also work with most tablets and ebook readers. I might just try it with my iPhone too. The verdict? I love my Lablog. It's just a thing to prop my iPad while I'm sitting in the comfy chair. It's definitely the cat's meow, although mine's purring in her sleep right now. Once again, this is Kirshen from freerangecoder.com, and I'll see you in the Bitstream.
Thanks, Kirshen. What a lovely and elegant solution to such a common problem. Next up, we have Rod Simmons from simplemobilereview.com, back with a review of the Plantronics Voyager Pro Plus.
Hi, Katie and fellow Nasilla Castaways. This is Rod Simmons from the Simple Mobile Review podcast, here to give you an overview of a product called the Plantronics Voyager Pro Plus Bluetooth headset. But first, let's start with a problem to solve. Many of us drive to work every day or sit at an office every day or in home office, and we're on our phones all day long. I'm one of those people who I'm fortunate enough to work from home except when I travel, and I like to sit at my desk all day using my mobile phone. And while being tethered to my mobile phone with a wired headset is great, having a Bluetooth headset that just nestles behind my ear, feels like it's almost not there, and lasts for 6 hours is a great solution. So that's the problem to solve. More importantly, when you're in your car driving, using hands-free is always critical, so this headset comes in handy for that as well. The reason why I like the Plantronics Voyager Pro Plus, I like the Voyager Pro as well, but the Plus adds an additional feature I'll talk about in just a moment. It's probably the most comfortable fitting headset I've worn to date, and I've worn many of them. I've had the Motorola Oasis, I've had various Jawbone headsets, and by far, the Plantronics Voyager Pro is absolutely my favorite. Plantronics' design is they have a decent-sized battery that actually nestles behind your ear and sits really comfortably. You almost don't really notice it's there after a little bit of time. And then it wraps around your ear, and it puts essentially the earbud kind of inside of your ear canal. Not too deep in there that could be uncomfortable like in-ear earbuds, but just resting right against there so you can hear sound crystal clear. The volume controls on the unit are phenomenal. I've never had the volume all the way up because it's just way too loud. But unlike many other headsets, I've never struggled to hear what somebody was saying on the other side. And the boom microphone that comes off of the earbud goes right down towards your mouth, and it gives crystal clear sound on the other side of the call. So while it's not the greatest if I were going to be in a windstorm, for that I would use something like a Jawbone. If you're going to be sitting at your desk or in your car, it is an absolutely fantastic headset. I've never had a complaint from a single person I've talked to when I've been using my Plantronics Voyager Pro Plus or Plantronics Voyager Pro. Now, why the Plus? What they've done as a change in this model, there's a couple features, but the real one that they've added in the Pro and the Pro Plus is A2DP, which is essentially Bluetooth streaming. So I can turn on the Oscilloscast, have my Bluetooth headset in, and have it going right over the headset right into my phone, or right from my phone into the headset. And the nice thing about that is that when a call comes in, like we all know, the podcast fades down, I take the call, then when the call ends, it transitions back, and I just continue listening. While I don't mind sitting at my desk using the speakerphone, you know, you don't have to annoy people around you. And the great thing is that I can just quietly listen to it in my head, and I can get up and move around in my office, and I know that it's really quick and easy to hear. So by far, my favorite Bluetooth headset has been the Plantronics Voyager Pro Plus. You can answer calls from the headset, you can hang up calls from the headset, and most importantly, you can activate voice-activated dialing or voice-activated features on your device. So if you're looking for a good Bluetooth headset that has about 6 hours of battery life, extremely comfortable, and has great vocal qualities, I would consider the Plantronics Voyager Pro Plus.
So if Allison was here, she would tell you all about Text Expander from Smile Software. But since she's not, and there's nothing she can do about it right now, I'm going to tell you all about one of my favorite Smile Software applications, PDF Pen. Now, Allison doesn't live in a world with PDFs. She, you know, I don't know. She just doesn't do the whole PDF thing. But I love PDFs. I like to edit them and I like to sign them and I send them around instead of faxes. And I use PDFs every day in my job. PDF Pen is one of the apps that I must have on my Mac. PDF Pen from Smile lets you easily edit PDFs. You can add text, images, and signatures. One of my favorite uses of PDF Pen is when someone sends me a document that I need to sign. For example, like the gazillion pieces of paper that you have to sign when you're trying to get a mortgage for a new house. I have a signature that I have scanned in and initials to into my PDF Pen library that I simply download the PDF, open it up in PDF Pen, and then transfer my signature over and then mail the file back to them. The people that I work with at the bank were amazed at how quickly I could turn around documents. Because think of the alternative. Otherwise, they have to fax you a document, you have to sign it, you have to fax it back, and you've got to deal with junky fax machines on both sides. And by the time your document finally gets to the place that's supposed to go, nobody can read anything. PDF Pen makes it so much simpler. With the regular version of PDF Pen, you can do all of that, but if you need more, check out PDF Pen Pro, which allows you to create your own PDF forms. I use that a lot with my clients because I do a lot of the same things in my practice every day. So I fill out questionnaires and I send it to them, and my clients can fill them out and email them back to me. And I've got a nice, simple PDF form that I can read without having to scrounge around and try to read somebody's handwriting on a form that they filled out on a clipboard in my front office. PDF Pen is available from Smile Software for $59.95, and PDF Pen Pro is available for $99.95. Both are available either from smilesoftware.com or the Mac App Store and have a 90-day money-back guarantee if for any reason you're unhappy. But if you want to try before you buy, head over to their website and you can download a free trial. Well, we all know that Allison could not keep her nose out of the show for an entire show, right? So she was able to pull herself away from vacation just long enough to submit this review.
Hi, everyone. Allison here from vacation in Mammoth Lakes, California. I hope you're having a grand time with Katie hijacking my show. I'm sure she's doing a fabulous job. Well, I was sitting out on the deck drinking a nice Malbec wine with the sun setting over the mountains, and I just realized I couldn't keep my nose out of the show for the whole week. There wasn't any way that was going to work. So I'm going to give you a quick review of a new application in the Mac App Store. You've heard me over the years singing the virtue of Reggie Ashworth's App Delete software, right? Well, this fantastic little app will let you drag applications onto it and delete all the cruft lying around your operating system. That way you can keep things running smoothly and efficiently. Well, App Delete runs you about $7.99 from ReggieAshworth.com. But hey, that's old news, right? Let's give you a new problem to solve. How about you're running a fleet of Macs at your house like I am, and $8 per system is maybe a bit too rich for your blood? Or what if you're a control freak? You really like to know what's going on in your system. So letting an application auto-delete all the cruft that goes with an application might just not be your style. Enter App Delete Lite, which is new in the Mac App Store. App Delete Lite, in the words of Tim Verporten, does one thing and does it well. It shows you all the pieces of junk to be deleted along with your application and shows you the path name to each piece of that extra junk. You know, things like plist and log files, all of that kind of nasty stuff. And it allows you to easily click the path to delete them individually all by yourself so you know exactly what you're doing. It's really kind of interesting learning where the application hides all these critical and yet sometimes annoying bits of the program. You know, as I was working on this, I realized I can think of another use for App Delete Lite. Let's say you have an application that's giving you the spinning beach ball of death or misbehaving in some other way. This using App Delete Lite would be the single fastest way to find the corrupted plist that's wrecking your application. I don't know about you, but I'm always scrolling through com.apple.blah blah 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 trying to find the right plist to delete to get my application to behave again. So that's a great use of App Delete Lite. And now, for the best part, since App Delete Lite is in the Mac App Store, that means it's licensed for all of the Macs that you own and operate for your personal use, and it's only $3.99. If you want complete control over what you delete, and you want a quick and easy way to find errant plists, then head on over to the link in the show notes to App Delete Lite in the Mac App Store. All right, Katie, show's all yours. Have fun with the Nocilla Castaways.
All right, so I guess it's back to me, huh? Well, thanks to everyone for submitting your reviews to help me out in this marathon show, but I think we have room for one more segment. And I want to share with you all a recent tale of woe, but don't worry, it has a happy ending. I'm sharing with you a recent experience when my less than 1-year-old MacBook Air suffered a sudden and unprovoked hardware failure and died on me without warning one night right before I was scheduled to give a major presentation. But because I'd done some pre-planning, I survived the ordeal, and I hope by sharing my experience that you can too. So let's set the stage. It started out just like any other evening. Thunderclaps here. I returned from work one day, tending to my normal evening computing routines, updating podcasts, checking RSS feeds, viewing my emails, and suddenly the spinning pinwheel of death appeared on my computer, and it was completely unresponsive. With little choice, I pressed the power button and waited for my machine to reboot. When it did, I was greeted with a kernel panic, and if you've never seen a kernel panic before, count yourself lucky. This is a daunting screen that tells you in several different languages, just in case you didn't get the message, that something really, really bad has happened and your computer can't recover. Not good. I remembered my troubleshooting techniques. I unplugged all external devices and rebooted again. This time, a folder with a question mark. That's bad, too. So I grabbed the USB key that came with the Air and was able to reboot it, but Disk Utility did not see a hard drive. This is looking more and more like a hardware problem. So I phoned AppleCare. When I got on the line with the first level tech support, I always politely identify myself as an experienced Mac user and troubleshooter and identify the steps that I've already taken to resolve the problem in the hopes of avoiding some of the normal stuff, like, is it plugged in? Unfortunately, that didn't seem to work this time. The first tier tech insisted that all I needed to do was archive and install the operating system. However, she didn't seem to understand that I couldn't do that when Disk Utility won't see a hard drive. After about 10 minutes of convincing, she put me on hold to consult with her supervisor, and we finally decided that my computer was going in for repair. Thankfully, because I practice what I preach in the area of backup, data loss was a non-issue. It wasn't even something I had to think about, and it took a load off my mind at an already stressful time. I had a clone backup of the drive from the night before, and the crash had done less than an hour's worth of work on that machine since that backup. I also use CrashPlan to create offsite backups of my data, and that updates every 15 minutes. I also have a second CrashPlan backup of my entire home directory on my Drobo on the local network, just for good measure, and a time capsule that stores hourly backup of my machine. So, pretty good to go in the backup route. But the newest addition to my backup strategy, one that I really didn't consider a backup, turned out to be the most useful. This time, I had recently transitioned my documents folder to my Dropbox. It meant that all of my documents were instantly up to date and accessible from my iPad, iPhone, or through the Dropbox web interface. I also use cloud solutions for much of my data, including IMAP email, calendars, and contacts, all syncing via MobileMe and Google Reader for RSS feeds. One of my very first concerns was the fact that I was scheduled to give 2 keynote presentations at a nearby Mac users groups the next evening. Thankfully, the work on these presentations was completed, so it was just a matter of retrieving the files and giving the actual presentations. This is where my recently implemented strategy of storing documents in Dropbox saved the day. Because I use Keynote for my presentations, I had completed copies of the presentation sitting in my Dropbox folder, and using the Dropbox app on iPad, I was able to retrieve the presentations and use the Open In feature to have them opened in the Keynote iPad app. One presentation used fairly simple transitions and imported flawlessly. Another was more involved and used complicated builds that were simplified in the conversion process, but I ran through the slides and they were perfectly acceptable for the presentation. Thankfully, I'd also previously purchased the Apple VGA adapter, so I could use my iPad with the group's projector. Now, I like to stand and talk when giving a presentation, so the idea of sitting behind a desk swiping at the iPad wasn't appealing. But then I remembered the Keynote Remote app for iPhone was recently updated, so decided to give it a second look. Now, the app allows you to pair Keynote on the iPad with the iPhone via Bluetooth or Wi-Fi to not only trigger the slide transitions, but also to let you see the current and next slide as well as any presenter notes. While the remote, aka the iPhone, was a bit clunkier than I was accustomed to, it did allow me to control the presentation while walking around the front of the room. I connected to the devices via Wi-Fi and noticed the occasional lag, so the triggers weren't always instantaneous. Next time I think I'll try Bluetooth, but the presentation went off without a hitch. One problem was updating podcasts in the week while my machine was gone. Normally I use iTunes and Apple's iPod app on the iPhone for most of my podcasts, but many people love Instacast and it didn't really fit well into my workflow. The main reason is because I use an iPhone and an iPod shuffle while at the gym, and I sync podcasts to it. And Instacast is great on the iPhone, it doesn't work for keeping my gym shuffle in sync. My car's audio system also defaults to playing whatever's on the iPod, so it's a manual procedure to start and stop Instacast. However, with the computer gone and updating podcasts through iTunes becoming more and more of a pain, Instacast to the rescue. Since I first tested the app, the developer has made several improvements, but unfortunately my car's audio system and the shuffle limitations will still probably keep me from using it as my full-time podcast player. But I loved having access to all of my podcasts while being able to listen to them whenever I wanted without a big production. If I could figure out a workaround to keep the shuffle, or even an iPod Nano, because I don't want to use my iPhone at the gym, in sync, I'd gladly use Instacast as my primary player. For everyday activities, the iPad fits nicely in a pinch for the rest of my computing needs. Email, web surfing, Twitter are easy enough on an iPad. Tools like Dropbox and Goodreader give me access to my files when necessary, and I wish more applications had built-in Dropbox support, especially the Apple iWork apps. However, I still have access to my iDisk, so I saved quite a few documents there and used Goodreader as an intermediary, but you know that's not going to stay around forever. DropDev could have solved this problem, but I just don't use the service enough to justify the $5 monthly price. And having one password on the iPad when my Mac was gone allowed me to have access to all of my websites and passwords securely so I could pay bills and get business done while the Mac was away. The Bluetooth keyboard was also helpful when needed to do more long-form writing, and a good chunk of this blog post was actually written using Pages on the iPad to get back in touch with the Bluetooth keyboard. I did cheat a little bit and borrow my mom's MacBook Pro for a couple of hours one evening to record an episode of Mac Power Users with David, and I was prepared to do a workaround using Skype on the iPad and a USB headset with the iPad camera connection kit, and David would have had to record the conversation on his side and do the editing and save the recording in our Dropbox for me to edit when my air returned, but I just couldn't figure out a way to record my own audio on Skype and save it on the iPad. But it would have worked in a pinch, but I might not have had the best audio quality. While I hope that Apple's iCloud service will make this process a little more seamless in the future, the real saving grace to this whole situation was having my documents stored in Dropbox so they were accessible for the iPad. When my Mac returned, the new files I added to Dropbox were right back on my Mac. While I had plenty of backups to the documents without the Dropbox, I would have had no way to access them using the iPad alone. Now, I could have tried to borrow friends' computers for the presentations and pull the documents out of Dropbox out of my backup drive, but in this case, I didn't have to inconvenience everyone else. This episode also brought up another concern. And what about the security of my data while my computer was in for repair? I knew it was standard procedure, but I still cringed when the AppleCare service rep asked me for my administrative password to my account. They were the keys to my kingdom. My entire life is on that machine, and giving up my admin password could mean that some nefarious person could have the command codes to my entire life. I tried to talk my way around it because, you know, they really don't need it. I had a bad motherboard. I knew that. Just put a new one in and make sure the machine turns on and we'll be good. But no dice. I knew Apple's policy. Normally when I send a machine in for service, I take precautions and even wipe the drive before I do so. But in a case of a sudden failure like this where I could not get my Mac to respond, that wasn't an option. Now, as far as companies go, I'd probably trust Apple more than most with my information. And I've been told by several people inside the company that their confidentiality and data disposal policies are very strong. But still, the thought made me uneasy. While the hard drive alone would likely be of minimal value, the combination of the hard drive and my admin password could be disastrous. Fortunately, some of the precautions I put into place prior to the hard drive failure probably served to protect most of my confidential data in the unlikely event of a breach. This incident has also started me thinking about what steps I could have taken in advance, especially when your Mac is at its most vulnerable. So here's what I've come up with so far. Use a secure password manager and set the password to something other than your login password. I've preached at length about the need to have unique secure passwords, but that's only good if your password manager is secure as well. obviously it should not be the same password as your login password. And if someone has your admin password to your Mac, that's going to be the first thing that they try. Also, use the features of your password manager. It surprised me how many people use a solution like 1Password or another password generation tool, but aren't finding and eliminating the similar or weak passwords. Your passwords should all be unique and random. Don't repeat them across sites, ever. Consider using disk encryption. Now that it's come in age with Lion, just keep in mind that in case of File Vault, once you give up your admin password, you've just unencrypted it. But if your admin password and your disk are separate, your disk is secure. Also consider using secure disk images. You can create a secure disk images for your most sensitive files and store your secure information in there, and they are inaccessible without your disk image password, regardless of whether someone has access to your account. The only problem is that these images are typically stored as a single file, sometimes as a bundle, so if your image becomes corrupt, you can lose all of your data. Backups are important. Consider using an alternative admin account. If Apple wants an administrative password, give them one, but to a different admin account. Just remember that under Lion, if you've enabled File Vault, that you will have to have a password that will unencrypt your hard drive before Apple can do any work. Also, consider changing your default keychain password. This is where passwords for many items are stored, including your mail accounts, your wireless routers, etc. By default, your keychain password is the same as your login password for convenience. And while changing this password makes your Mac a little less user-friendly, because it can be a pain to unlock it every time you want to do something else, it does make your Mac a lot more secure. The other thing to consider is using security features offered by the cloud. This may sound a little counterintuitive, but if you have sensitive items stored in a cloud-based solution like Dropbox, you can usually use the web interface to remove those files from your computer the next time it tries to connect. The options vary by service, but they may be worth checking out. Just be careful what you put on the web. If you have a special situation, explain it and ask. While it may not be a common procedure, especially if you're not taking your Mac in for repair at a local facility, you may ask the tech or management for the return of your original hard drive or proof that it was destroyed. And again, this is going to be more difficult if you have to ship your machine away, but still may be possible. Just be prepared that you may have to pay something for the defective part. For example, I had a defective time capsule replaced under AppleCare a few years ago, but the defective unit still worked well enough to access data. And while I did have to take the functioning time capsule to Apple for diagnosis, the manager, although he did require a credit card hold, allowed me to take the old unit home for 24 hours so that I could perform a secure erase on the drive and then return it to him. Now, this is by no means a comprehensive list of precautions that you should take with your Mac, and nor is it intended to be. But for a review of that topic, you might want to check out Mac Power Users Episode 10, Mac Security. Overall, my week without a computer went okay. I did have my work PC at the office for all of my work-related activities, and I have not seen any sign that any of my data or privacy was compromised, and I feel confident the security measures I put in place pre-failure protected my most sensitive data. With the possible exception of recording the podcast, there was nothing mission-critical I had to do that couldn't be accomplished on the iPad in such a short time frame. However, I am planning on buying a Mac Mini when all these new housing expenses settle down, to use as a home server and a backup computer. I've been considering this purchase for a while, although this recent episode has highlighted that need. This is another one of those cases where a little preparation on the front end can save you a lot of hassle on the back end, because you never know when a hardware failure is going to strike. It's time for my favorite time of the week. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. How you doing, Bart?
I'm doing good, but you don't sound like Allison.
No, I'm not. You know, Allison has been on vacation for the last week.
Well, I've been seeing her photos. They certainly look like she's been having fun. She managed not to kill herself on a mountain bike. That was good.
Yeah, and lots of bears. Steve has been hanging out with bears. But she was on her way back yesterday. I actually got a phone call from her, and she was in the car on the way back. She decided to come back a day early, and she said, you know, I'm coming back. I can actually do Chit Chat Across the Pond if you want. And I said, Allison, you've made me do all the hard work of the show all by myself, and now you want to come in and do the easy part? I don't think so.
Yeah, for a few years I did Allison's show while on holidays, but I don't have the internet to do the actual live plate spinning bit. And I was always surprised by how much more work there was in the 1 hour long Nasillacast than in a 2 hour plus long IMP.
It's a very different kind of show, but it's a lot of fun. But she,
yeah, it certainly is. And the community is really nice, actually. When you stand in for Allison's show, she puts out the big announcement, you know, please help poor Bart or poor Katie. And then like millions of people email you stuff. It's wonderful.
They do. They do. Lots of people have helped out. So it will be great. But Allison will be in the chat room as I'm doing the live show. I'm sure backseat driving the entire way.
That could be interesting. I'll do my best to be there.
Oh, well, I think it will definitely be interesting. So on one hand, I think it'll be nice to have a little bit of technical support should I need it. But on the other hand, a little nerve-wracking, too. It's kind of like the teacher standing over your shoulder.
Well, have you been given moderator rights in the IRC chat room?
I don't know if I have in Justin.tv, because, you know, we've got that whole new setup now.
That's true, because otherwise, you see, if she gets too annoying, you can just boot her from the room.
Oh, it's a good idea. Maybe Steven can help me out with that.
I'm sure he can. He has the power.
All right. So we've got some security stuff going on this week.
We do. We have a little bit of security light. I've picked slightly more than just from this week because it's been a while since I've been here. The first thing is that Mozilla have updated Firefox. And they're still in the middle of that confusing, let's just play with numbers because it's fun thing.
Oh, yeah. What's going on with that? We're like on Firefox 12 now, it seems.
Well, 6. But okay. Yeah. All I can see is that they have envy of size and they just want to get bigger. There's no rhyme or reason to this. They said at the start of the year, we're going to Firefox 6 this year, and they've been as bad as their word. This means that when you go, Firefox plugins are written for one major Firefox version, and they have to be recompiled, etc., for every new version of Firefox.
Yeah, it's breaking plugins.
Yeah, so by going from 3 to 4, that was expected, because, well, you know, we were on 3.6, we were due to go to 4, that's reasonable. Then we should have been on 4.1 and 4.2, but instead they decided to call it 5 and 6. And by calling it 5 and 6, they've broken everyone's plugins. So there is no security support whatever for 4. There is no security support whatever for 5. So either you were smart like me and you didn't fall for this silly race and you're still on Firefox 3.6, in which case the safe version to be is 3.6.20, which was also released this week. Or if you foolishly went to 4, you're now stuck in a rat race. If you want to be safe, you have to go to 5. And if you want to be safe, you now have to go to 6. And at each one of those hops, you've probably lost a few of your plugins.
Wait, so I have to either be 3 versions behind or on the most recent version?
Yes, you have to be on the 3.6 branch or on what I call the 4 branch, because it should be 4. We should be on 4.2, basically.
But this is exhausting.
It's just silliness. I mean, they should have just done a Netscape and just skipped a few numbers. Netscape went from 5 to 7. Who cares?
Is this all because Internet Explorer's like on a big number?
9.
Yeah.
They're on 9. Chrome are on something like 11 or 12. But because Chrome auto updates in the background, I actually don't know what version Chrome is on unless I go and look for it. So it's silly to try compete with Chrome. What's it on now? Oh, 13. Amazing how quickly it's been moving. Yeah, so Chrome is on 13. So they're going to keep up with that. They're really going to cause trouble. I don't know. It's just absolute madness. I don't see it at all. But basically, people are constantly left in the choice of either break plugins or be secure, which is a horrible choice to give people because they may rely on those plugins.
So just you go to like getfirefox.com and download the most recent version, or you just, if you're on the 3 branch, you just check for updates and make sure that you're in the most recent version there.
Exactly, which would be 3.6.20. And that's where I, on my home machine, I've stayed on the 3 branch and it's working quite well. In work, I didn't rely on any plugins, so I've been playing along in the rat race just to see. And right. I can't particularly see why 6 is so much better than 3.
No, I haven't really noticed it either. Now, Bart, kind of off topic for just a moment, but you know, keeping with updates, do you use or recommend any of this auto update software that's out there? You know, like Mac Update has a version, or CNET uses Tech Tracker. I actually use CNET Tech Tracker, which tends to be reasonable. Do you use any of that stuff?
I don't. I tend to just rely on the apps because pretty much everything auto-updates itself. And the nice thing is in the future, I can just see the App Store being my one and only place for updates.
You know, my big thing is I used CNET Tech Tracker for a while because I actually heard from you that there was a Firefox update that was an important security issue. And I had no idea because now Firefox does auto-update, but for the longest time it didn't. So I've got CNET Tech Tracker running in the background. And sure enough, I always find, you know, updates that I didn't know about because these things don't auto-update. But a lot of people don't like it because it can be kind of intrusive, and sometimes it's wrong.
Yeah, I can't remember which one I used. It wasn't CNET's one. It was a different one I used a few years ago. And it was okay, but then Sparkle, which is sort of a framework that's available for apps to use, became very popular.
Right.
And just about every app I started using started to do the standard Sparkle self-update thing, which is, you recognize Sparkle as being the thing when you launch the app and then it pops up and says, there's a new version available. Do you want to download and install? Yes or no? That's the Sparkle framework in action.
Right.
And very, very many apps use that. And I just decided that I was happy enough with that. But as we're about to discover in our second story, although 99.9% of apps auto-update, even Flash has managed to learn to auto-update at long last after many years, not all of them do. And one that I am immensely disappointed in, and it's an app and a service that I love, but they just know how to get security wrong. They're just very good at that. And that's Dropbox.
Aww.
Again.
Really?
Yeah, they still don't have auto updates. Welcome to the 21st century, not.
They're on probation with me.
They are with me too. There's nothing up there that's earth-shatteringly important or earth-shatteringly private, because they've just been eroding away at my trust. Like, you know, they make one slip and you go, it can happen to anyone. And I've given them the benefit of the doubt on a few occasions on this very segment, in fact. Because on the one hand, they've been very good at being open when they get things wrong. But on the other hand, they're doing it a little too often. And, you know, coming clean about it, you know, mea culpa works once, might work twice, but I think they might have run out of mea culpas.
So what's wrong with Dropbox? Because I haven't updated it recently.
Well, apparently it's supposed to figure out that it needs an update all by itself, but it doesn't seem to do so. And I've never seen Dropbox do it. So you really have to manually check. And there's been a few security issues. So you should now go to your system preferences. And you should go across to the Dropbox tab. No, you shouldn't. Okay, I'm almost seeing a very old version here.
I think there's a little menu bar for Dropbox.
That's where the preferences are. Sorry. Yeah. So you go to the Dropbox menu bar, you go to preferences, and then in there should be an update. There should be a checkbox somewhere that checks whether you're on the latest version.
I am not. I am on 1.1.35.
So am I.
Yep. All right. I'll start downloading that right away.
And we should say to people, you should be on 1.1.40.
Okie dokie. I don't even see a link here to auto-update, so I think I'm just going to have to go to their website and do it.
There's absolutely no support whatever. There's no button check for update. There's no button get update, anything like that. You have to go to the website and download it again. It's like something from the last century. It's quite poor.
Lovely.
So, a bit disappointed in that. As I say, even Adobe have managed to do better. There's a nice article, actually, over on the Mac security blog at Intego, which sort of goes through the situation with Dropbox. So if people want to learn a little bit more, that's probably a good place to look.
Okay.
And the last thing I wanted to throw in, it's not technically this week's news, it's news from the week before, but it's significant enough that I thought it might be worth mentioning. Adobe, on the 10th of the month, which is the second Tuesday, so they were tagging along with Microsoft, they released a biggie. Or rather, at least many security updates. So they have patched Shockwave, they have patched Flash Media Server, they have patched Flash itself, they have patched Photoshop CS5, and they have patched something I've never even heard of called RoboHelp.
I have no idea what that is.
With the exception of the RoboHelp one, all the other four are labeled critical severity, while RoboHelp is only important severity. I still don't know what RoboHelp
is. Probably because nobody has it.
Yeah, probably. So Flash should have auto-updated itself if you're on an even vaguely modern version. Now, if your Flash is out of date by 5 versions, it will never auto-update itself because they only introduced auto-update when they went to Flash 10.
Right.
So if you haven't had Flash pop up and ask you, then you should go to Adobe's site and download the latest Flash. And if it has popped up and asked you, then at least that one's safe.
Now, I actually had an issue with Flash with Lion that I had to go manually update because when trying to get together and do the test run for Allison's show, I had a problem where it popped up that little box that says, and it's a security precaution, do you want to allow this to use your microphone and camera, when I was on Justin TV and on Ustream, and the little box would not go away. And it was a bug with Line and Adobe Flash. And the next week, of course, after we Googled for an hour for a workaround, Adobe released an update that fixed the bug. But
well, at least it got fixed. That was probably, in fact, this update from the 10th, then, was it?
It was. I think that was this update.
Yeah.
So, Allison just thought I was doing it wrong.
Operator trouble, as Allison would say.
I'm sure.
Well, anyhow, so that's the latest from Adobe, a nice big update. Although, shockingly, there's no update there for Acrobat.
Hmm. All right, so I'm in bad shape. Two out of the three I had to do. Firefox and Dropbox.
Yeah, well, that's not bad shape. That's just shape.
Well, I'm up to date now.
Pretty good.
All right, well, this is why we have you here.
Exactly. So that's all of our security vegetables. So now we can go on to the fun stuff, as Alison would say.
I'm excited about this. This is a cool topic.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been lying in bed and been struck by inspiration to the point that I've jumped out of bed, grabbed my iPad and started typing frantically. But it happened the night before last. I've been sort of mulling over Lion, and I didn't really want to do a segment on it until I'd had plenty of time to play with it, until I'd had time to sort of put it into context in my head and figure out what I really think of it. And something that's been nagging away at me is this meme that's doing the rounds, that Lion is the start of the end of OS X, it's being iPadified, it's being dumbed down, is the phrase you always hear people saying. And just this general sort of doom saying that what the future of the Mac is, that it's going to be just like the iPad, where power users have no actual power anymore, and it's all for simplicity and not for power. And it just hasn't struck me as ringing true with the experience of using the actual OS. I'm using Lion, and I don't see any of this.
Okay.
But what I hadn't been able to sort of put into words is what I did see in its place, and it finally came to me. I think we're not heading for an iPad future. I think we're heading for a Star Trek future.
Well, I'm all for that.
Yeah. So let me be a little more specific about that, because I don't mean we're going to fly around in spaceships.
Well,
unfortunately. I hope we do. That'd
then
be fun.
Maybe I'm not for that then.
In particular, what came to my mind was the Next Generation Star Trek universe, because that's just where I grew up. I think that's why that's the one that always jumps to mind for me. But think Captain Picard's Starship Enterprise. And then start thinking about how they compute.
Okay.
And there's no sign that any one form factor has won the future there. You have bridge stations that are very clearly like desktops. Giant big screens, massive input panels, don't move, are stuck, have a lot of power and seem to have much more ability than little things do.
So this is Worf's tactical station, and this is Data's navigation.
Well, I was going to say, think even bigger.
Okay.
I mean, those would definitely count too, but think behind Worf on the back wall. If that isn't a desktop equivalent, I don't know what is.
Okay.
You know, where Data sits down to do his really hard work, which I guess proves the point. He gets up from his normal station, he moves to that big station when he has to do something hard. To me, is a desktop. It hasn't gone away.
My true geekness is coming out here, isn't it?
Well, I think both of us. Then you have things that look a lot like laptops. If you go into Captain Picard's ready room, if you go into Dr. Crusher's office, you see these little things that look immensely like netbooks or like little laptops. A little screen, a little input area, useful for, you know, a lot of stuff, but not quite as powerful as the big bridge stations.
The little things that sit on their desk.
Yeah, the little things that sit on their desk and they can spin around and stuff. Okay. I don't know if they can move them. I've never seen them pick it up and walk away with it, but since there's computers everywhere, I'm not sure the walking away bit is that important.
Okay.
So they look like laptops to me. Then obviously everyone knows that, you know, the iPad is the little pad from Star Trek. I've always been saying I wanted a little Star Trek pad, and then Apple made the iPad, and I don't think anyone can not see the link there.
And it's called the iPad.
It's called, exactly. And in Star Trek, they're called pads.
It would have been so much better if they'd added an additional D.
It would have, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
but they have them in all different shapes and sizes, but they have lots of pads in Star Trek, so that bit's easy. And then the other one that sort of comes to mind as a little portable computer that they do use a lot when they're on away missions and stuff is the humble little tricorder. Very little screen real estate, very little input space, but they still manage to do a lot with it. And to me, that's actually quite like the iPhone.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say that any form factor has won the future. Well, the future is, in fact, that you have lots and lots of form factors and ubiquitous computers, and for every situation, they have developed a computer that fits that situation best. So there is no one definitive computer of the future. There are lots and lots of computers of the future.
Well, and you come back from your away mission and you drop your data from your tricorder into the main computer or, I guess, whatever. Yeah.
Well, it happens automatically, which is the other thing, of course, is that with this ubiquitous computers everywhere, you also have your data being sort of ethereal and your data's just there. You never, ever hear Captain Picard say, wait a second, it's on my other pad.
Right.
You don't see anyone saying that. They're typing away at something at their desk, and then they go to the bridge, or they go into the ready room or something, or so it's a conference room, and they bring it up on the big screen.
So
there's never any worry about where the data is. It just happens. It's just there. It's ubiquitous. And that is certainly a part of the Star Trek future as well, a very important part.
So is this like iCloud?
I would say, yeah.
Okay.
So if you look at the alternative point of view, it should be that one form factor beats out other form factors and stuff should be getting replaced. So it's been well over 20 years since the desktop came out in 1984, if you want to take the Mac point of view, or even earlier if you want to take other desktops. Why isn't it gone? If stuff replaces stuff, why is a desktop still here over 20 years later? That doesn't fit into that theory, does it?
Well, if you go back to Steve Jobs' analogy at All Things D, we still need trucks.
Exactly. And the truck didn't kill, the car didn't kill the truck, the sports car didn't kill the car.
The scooter didn't kill the car. The
scooter, nothing kills the car, exactly. So it's an additive future. So I think that if you just look at the facts, I now have two desktops I use daily, one at work, one at home. I have a laptop I use daily. I have an iPad I use daily, and I have an iPhone I use daily. None of these have replaced each other. They've all just added to my experience and made it easier for me, but nothing's replaced anything else.
Well,
that's why the whole iPadification of the Mac doesn't stack up with me, because this is not this is technology. Computing has not shown itself to be about replacing. It's shown itself to be about making things better. The terminal is still there. And it's still used. I use the damn thing every single day. It is the best way for me to do my system administration work. It is better than any GUI anyone could ever make, because I can do more with it. It's still there, and it's been there since the very, very start of computing. Nothing goes away.
But I don't have to, and you can. You don't have to.
Exactly, yes.
Right.
So what is happening is that there are layers being put on to make things easier. So anyone who doesn't have to look under the hood doesn't have to look under the hood. They don't have to be bothered by that. And there are more and more layers being painted on. If you look at Lion, this is very clearly the case. This whole sort of app launcher, we all think it's silly because we're power users.
Yeah,
we're never
going
to use it. I mean, I hit command space to launch an app and I start typing into Quick Look and then it comes up instantly because I'm a keyboard person.
So you use Spotlight though, right?
I use Spotlight because I like not having to install stuff. I like to be able to sit down at any Mac and just work.
Right. I use Launch Bar, but I've tweaked it so that command space is also Launch Bar, so that I've got that muscle memory when I'm at a Mac that doesn't have it.
That's a good way to do it, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't even use the dock as an app launcher. I just do everything with command space. I mean, if I want to do some math, I hit command space and I type in the sum and then it gives me the answer. If I'm trying to remember the definition of a word, whether a below with two L's is bellow or below, which I always mix those up, I type them into Quick Look and it gives me the dictionary definition straight in the results. But I'm doing that all the time. So for me, this app launcher thing that looks like an iPhone is a bit silly. But for my grandfather, who is, although he's very keen to be into IT, he's not a power user. And what he really wants is he wants to be able to organize his apps in a way that's easy to get at and into little folders. In Windows, he was one of those people who had their desktop meticulously organized into games in this area here and, you know, other stuff in this area here. Well, now he just has his desktops and he can create his little folders and he can drag and drop stuff around. And he has it set up with a hot corner, so he just moves the mouse down, the thing pops up, he clips the game he wants, and away he goes. So it's made life a lot easier.
Sure.
But it's actually part of something else, because it's not just about making it easier. It's also about making experiences you learn on one Apple product carry over to the others. If you learn how to use an iPad, you will be quite at home on a Mac in the future, and even with Lion in the present.
Well, that makes sense, because so many people already know how to use an iPad or an iPhone because there's so many out there, or if you just hand it to them, they're so intuitive that if you spend an hour or more with them, you're quite proficient.
Exactly. So let's say you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch. The interface on the iPad is not actually identical. It's actually the same and some, because there are interface elements that don't exist in the iPhone that exist in the iPad, like when, you know, if you're in horizontal mode in mail and you click on the inbox, this sort of pop-over thing comes up. That doesn't exist in the iPhone, that pop-over. That only exists in the iPad. But everything you've learned on the iPhone still helps you on the iPad. And everything you learn on the iPad should help you in OS X. And if you look at it that way, then full-screen apps, the reversing of the scrolling, the introduction of an awful lot of touch-based stuff, and this new app launcher, and indeed, I think, this whole idea of unifying spaces and stuff, it all makes a lot more sense. So you should be able to take your experience from the iPhone to the iPad to the Mac. And if you look at the Star Trek universe, you can instantly recognize a Federation computing panel, no matter what form factor it has, no matter what its function is. They all have a unified look and feel, even though they do different things. And that is where I see Lion going. So if we actually look at it, what power features have we lost with the move to Lion?
I guess off the top of my head, I can't really think of any.
I've been thinking about this a lot, and the only thing I came up with, and it's pretty weak, is that spaces have to be in a line now instead of in a grid.
Oh, I never used that.
Yeah, very few people. I did. I was one of those people, and I'm a very geometric person in my brain. And I always had a 4x4 grid that I would navigate around using control and the arrow keys. And that worked very well for me because I just like 4x4 grid worked good for me.
See, I'm actually using spaces more now because of the way it's set up.
Exactly. And you're not alone. Because at first I was cranky, and then I started using full screen apps. And then I realized that if you had a grid and you had these extra spaces appearing and disappearing as you made things full screen, it would drive you insane.
Right.
So they had to sacrifice the grid layout in order to give us this full screen experience. And to me, the full screen experience is actually more of a power feature than the grid was. So actually, I don't really think we've lost anything. But if you look at what was updated, we have whole disk encryption now. That's certainly a power feature, and that's come in. We have support for encrypting external hard drives. And if you look at stuff that got updated, the Finder got updated. It now has some more power features. Like if you drag one folder onto another, you can merge them instead of replacing them only and stuff like that. So they've actually made even the Finder a little bit more powerful. Arguably things they should have done years ago. But even the terminal got a little bit of love, and the terminal actually got some nice little updates. So when you reopen a terminal, you can see the text from your last session is now grayed out sort of above your current starting point. And so you can have a little look up at the last thing you were doing. Terminal now has full screen mode, and you can sort of tile terminal sessions within that big full screen mode. So they've updated the terminal. They made some updates to AppleScript. They made some updates to Automator. If this was about killing power features, why on earth would they update AppleScript and Automator on the terminal?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's certainly some features that I don't particularly like about the implementation about Lion, but I can't say that I've lost features.
Well, I've been using it now for a few weeks because I jumped in on day one, of course. And I haven't come across anything that I used to do that I can't do anymore. And I'm not an easygoing person when it comes to computers. I'm quick to criticize, and I tend to use a lot of features. And I haven't lost anything, but I have gained a lot.
Well, I think people might say, and this is not a fair criticism of Lion, people may say that they've lost things because they've lost compatibility, but that's not an Apple problem.
No, that's a temporal problem.
Right.
I guess what you have lost is the virtualization layer that was Rosetta.
Right.
Which was a transitional thing, which was there to ease the move from one CPU architecture to another. It served a very important purpose when it was there, because if that hadn't have been there, the change to Intel would have been a nightmare.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But for example, a very good friend of mine here locally, who's a member of my local Mac user group, I saw him on Thursday night. And he just looked beat. And I said, "Well, Glenn, what is wrong?" And he says, "I have never been busier than I've ever been right now." And I said, what are you doing? He says, "I am rolling people back from Lion." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, quite honestly, you know, to the extent that he can, he says, it's their own fault. You know, they saw Lion, they pushed the button, they upgraded, they did no prep work, they did no research, they knew nothing. And then all of a sudden, you know, applications that they used and stuff that they depended on didn't work. So I'm rolling them back. And apparently that's, you know, and the users that he is addressing, this being primarily a college town, you know, are users that don't have clone backups of their, you know, they didn't do the things that we talked about doing, you know, have a clone backup of your Snow Leopard installation and, you know, do this and do that and do things like, you know, so there's no easy way for them to roll back. So.
Yeah. Now, if software isn't working in Lion, that would raise alarm bells to me in the sense that why are you using something so old that hasn't been updated in years? Is that safe?
Absolutely not. But there's what we as power users and podcasters in our community tend to forget is that there is a huge segment out there who get a Mac, keep it for, you know, 4 to 7 years. And isn't it wonderful that you can, you know, that these computers have this life expectancy? And don't do anything with it. You know, they keep it, it works, and it works, you know, for the most part, reasonably well for them as it did on day one. And they don't, you know, when a little software update thing pops up, they update it. And, oh, okay, well, you know, oh, hey, this is out and let me do this. And, you know, they don't buy the latest and greatest, and they don't update the software, and they don't, you know, do a lot of the things that we talk about.
Yeah,
because what they have works until it doesn't.
Unfortunately, it appears to work. What it's actually doing is putting them at great risk.
I don't disagree with you.
It's something Apple have never been afraid of, and is to obsolete things. So,
oh my gosh,
individual technologies die, but ideas and form factors don't die, because obviously DOS died.
They killed the iPod Mini.
Hasn't.
They killed the iPod Mini, their most popular product. Dead.
Absolutely, and they do all that. I mean, Apple were the first to get rid of the floppy drive. Yeah. And now they're doing. They're the first to do it with the CD-ROM drive.
Yeah.
I mean, you buy a Mac Mini today, there is no CD-ROM drive. And people look at this. People look at it as being equally as insane as they looked at, you know, the removal of floppy from the first Bondi Blue iMacs. They thought that was mad, and now they think it's mad to take out the optical drive. But Apple have moved on from that.
Well, and Apple and Alice and I were talking about this a lot, and I may have gotten you off track a little bit, but Apple is pushing the envelope on these things, and they do it a little bit before we're comfortable with it, but. If they don't, we won't, if that makes sense. You know, Apple created, going back to the iPhone, Apple created the iPhone, which was completely different and completely revolutionary from anything that anybody was doing at the time. I mean, the iPhone looked like it came from Mars, you know, when you compared it to all of the other options that were available at the time. And here we are 5 years later, and now look at the smartphone landscape and how dramatically it has changed. And the tablet landscape, and even the laptop landscape, and how dramatically things have changed. And maybe, you know, we Mac geeks were comfortable with that, but I'm sure there were a lot of people who looked at the iPhone and said, I don't know what that is or what that does or interesting. And then they got intrigued, and then they got into it, and the world has changed. And if Apple doesn't make these changes a little bit sooner than we're ready for them to make, the world doesn't change.
And they wouldn't be Apple. Apple is not a company for conservative people.
Right.
If you don't like change, don't become a Mac user, because you're going to have change forced upon you regularly.
That's true.
And continuously. But, I mean, the thing everyone loves about Apple is that they're innovative and they're doing things differently. And the only way you can be innovative and do things differently is you have to be unafraid of breaking with the past. And so you have people saying, it's an absolute disgrace, you know, this Final Cut Pro 10 is completely different to Final Cut Pro 7. Yeah, it's Apple. That's what they do. They revolutionize, they reinvent. If you don't want any change, why are you an Apple customer?
Well, and look at how that has bogged down Microsoft by having so much legacy support for so long.
Exactly. I think that's the perfect... The two extremes are Apple, who have no fear of obsolescence, and Microsoft, who have an absolute phobia of it.
But they do have a little different customer base as well. I mean, Microsoft, who is still very deeply entrenched in the corporate and the business environment. You know, I know my office is still fully Microsoft, you know, probably because they have to be. You know, my office, and I shudder, is using Microsoft Office 2003. We're using Windows XP. We're using Microsoft Server 2003 edition.
And, I don't think you're alone in that by any stretch of the imagination.
And, you know, if you walked in and told my partners that, hey, guys, nothing's going to work next year. Just FYI.
They go nuts. They go complete bonkers. Yeah, but I think the reason Microsoft have that market is because of their attitude to change. I actually think that attitude to change predates their absolute dominance of the business world.
Yeah.
And I think the reason they dominate the business world is because they have a culture of conservatism. They do not... Change in Microsoft is optional. Change as a Mac user is generally not very optional. Or if it is optional, it's not optional for very long. Right now, if you don't like the reverse scrolling, there's a little checkbox to reverse it back. Don't expect to see that in whatever comes after Lion.
Yeah, I'm worried about that.
I'm not. I think it's amazing. I actually went and found a little app so I could reverse the scrolling on my MacBook Pro, which is too old to run Lion.
The only thing I don't, and I think my problem is that I switch between my Mac at home and my PC at work, and I use a mouse with a scroll bar, the little wheel thingy.
Wheel, yeah.
And to me, that just seems totally opposite. I don't know. Maybe I'll switch it back and see.
Well, if someone brings out a utility for Windows to reverse it, then I think it makes a lot more sense for you to consider changing it. But if you're going to be using both every day, don't change it. You will go mad.
Right.
Like, there's no point in you trying to change it at home if you can't change it at work, because it will drive you absolutely insane.
Well, I'm going to wait another couple of months and then bring up the topic of putting a Mac Mini on my desk at the office. There's no reason I can't use a Mac at the office.
That would be nice. I'm very, very lucky to be one of the people who can use a Mac at work. And I've been asked to justify it a few times, and I just said, productivity, straight up. I get more done this way.
Right.
And my boss has thought about it, and I said, look, it's not that much more expensive. And I get a lot more done. You know, I'm a Linux sysadmin. This is a Unix desktop machine. This is the right machine for me. And that argument held water, clearly.
Sure.
And hopefully there's other people in the workplaces who can make a similar argument and say, look, this isn't just a preference thing. This is a case of, you know, I can get more work done. I will give you value for money if you invest in this computer for me.
Oh, I know I could be more productive on a Mac at work. No question in my mind. There have been times at work that I have remote accessed into my Mac at home just so I could use PDF Pen.
Yeah. For me, it's actually the operating system level stuff. The system-wide autocorrect that's come in Lion, that's wonderful. I'd be very lost without that now. The whole Spaces and Exposé thing, the whole Time Machine thing has always been something that sets the Mac apart. There's just so many little things that the operating system does for you all the time that just makes you so much more productive. And of course, as I say, since I'm a Linux person by profession, having the terminal just sitting there makes everything just so seamless.
Right.
Anyway, I do think we've gone slightly off topic.
We have gone slightly off topic, but I think it was a good tangent.
Yes, I think so. Anyway, I'd sort of come to my point, really, that when I look at what's happened in terms of iCloud, which is very clearly about making your data ubiquitous, and when I look at Lion, what I see is a move towards a unified sort of design of Apple operating systems, where if you learn something on one, you can carry your knowledge over to the others, but not one where you lose features in any one of the form factors. Every form factor continues to do what it does best, but they all continue to do so in a more unified and more integrated sort of way. And I would call that the Star Trek future rather than the iPad future. And when I look at the facts, that's where I think Apple's going. I don't think the facts support the other point of view.
I don't think that's a bad future.
So I hope I'm right. You could argue it's wishful thinking, because it's certainly what I hope the future is. But when I look at the data, that's what I see.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a future that I would like to live in. And I hope that Apple, I hope that you're right, because it has been a fear of mine. And I think I addressed this when we did the Mac Roundtable at Macworld, that Apple would dumb down the desktop to satisfy the masses, that Apple would get rid of the trucks in favor of the cars. And I hope that is not the case. And I think Lion made me feel a little bit better because, as you said, and as you pointed out, there's really nothing that I, from Apple's standpoint, that I can't do with Lion that I could do with Snow Leopard.
I think they just made a better truck.
I think they made a better truck.
If you look at a modern truck, it's got all the fancy things you have in a car.
It has airbags now.
Yeah, the airbags and all this electronic goodness. And I mean, is there really that much difference when you sit on the cab of a truck to when you sit on the cab of a car at first glance?
It's bigger. That's about it.
Well, I mean, under the hood, it has infinitely more power, literally. But when you sit down at it, are you confused by the controls of a truck?
No. No.
So I think Steve's analogy continues to work.
I think it works. Yeah. All right, Bart. Well, this has been fun. This has been a very interesting topic.
Well, thank you. I'm glad inspiration came, because I was a bit worried by Wednesday that nothing had come to me. I was like, I'm going to do chit-chat across the pond, and I have no idea what I'm going to talk about. But eventually it came.
I wasn't worried. I knew you had it handled.
Allison always says that too.
Well, Bart, I don't know when the next time I'll have the opportunity to speak with you on Chit Chat Across the Pond, but I look forward to speaking with you again on the Mac Roundtable, I think.
Likewise. I suppose we should get a show of that together at some stage, but that's a topic for another day. Anyway, thank you very much for standing in for Allison, Katie. It was an absolute pleasure.
It was my pleasure indeed.
I suppose I should do my line, shouldn't I?
I think you have to.
Until next time, happy computing.
All right. Well, it has been an absolute blast hosting the show this week. Thank you to Allison and Steve for having a wonderful time on vacation and allowing me to do this. I want to say thanks to our sponsors, Screen Steps, and to Smile for helping us to pay the bills. I will see you all next time I get an opportunity to hijack the show. Allison will be back next week. And don't forget to stay subscribed.